It's the Help Show. Yes, we're here to discuss and solve your problems. Sorry it's been a month. We did try and get one going before I had a week away, but I'm afraid it never happened. So it was just all a last minute thing. But we're here back now, scheduled. This one didn't nearly happen, but we're here now. We've got a fantastic bunch of experts. We have Paul Wheatley joining me, top left, who's going to give all your answers to all your web questions. But we haven't got a lot of web questions. But he's also competent in the Mac and other areas as well and are developing. We've got Doc Rock, whose experience is unknown to me, I have to say, but I'm guessing it's wide and varied. Sarah, our Linux girl, is here as well, bottom right. And then Bart Bouchotz is joining us from the black hole that is Ireland, that doesn't allow him to have particularly good bandwidth, and Skype's not playing well, as it normally doesn't when he comes on this network. So,
but my bandwidth is great. I have 200 meg up and 10 meg, no, 200 meg down and 10 meg up. Right. The Skype app plays video for 10 seconds and then says, no, enough of that.
Have you got the latest version?
Well, it says it is. It won't update itself any further.
Okay, so there you go, chat room.
Because I'm in Ireland and I'm using Windows 7. Right, PC for Skype, it's fine.
I'm on a Mac, but either way, it, as of a few weeks ago, it just started to do that. The little light comes on the camera for 10 seconds and then it just goes off.
Hardware fault, I'm guessing. But we'll answer your questions because we're all technical competent here now. Honest. Even though we can't solve Bart's Skype problems. We've all got a talk. Our first question that's come in. One of them was, the first thing that came in was from Serenyak Assassin. And he wanted to say about the Help Show, he listened to the Freeware Shareware podcast that we did and said he enjoyed it. Thank you very much. Couple of comments. For what it's worth, there's a full native version of GIMP, should you be so inclined. It looks like an X11 app, but it is native. In the options, you can choose either the traditional multi-window mode or the more Mac-like single window mode, and you find it here at gimp.lisanet.de/website/download.html. Seashore is a real Mac app, but I think that was an advert that I've pasted in from what he's written, so thanks very much for putting that one in.
That is a good tip, actually, because one of the things that I use GIMP a lot, and one of the things that irritates me is the multi-window thing. Really is irritating.
The X11 on OS 10 was always an awful experience for the GIMP, because you know, when I used to be a Linux desktop user, and then I switched to the Mac, and so I thought, oh great, GIMP works on the Mac, and it was so horrible with that X11, especially if you were running another X11 app at the same time, and it just completely mucked up your command tab and everything. So I've been using this native Mac version for a couple of years, since it came out, really. I think it's a year or two now, and it actually makes the GIMP tolerable on the Mac. It's still a user interface designed by nerds and therefore horrible to use, but compared to what it was, it's gotten way better.
Is it the GIMP or just GIMP?
It's the GIMP, GNU image manipulation GIMP, program. So the GIMP. Pulp Fiction.
No, I'm the same. I've never referred to it with the in the front of it. I've never heard of that before, because I think it just makes it worse. That's a name that's right for Mickey Take anyway. And
that makes it funnier.
It just makes it worse.
Bart, you say you've used Seashore though.
So basically, when I switched to the Mac, I went, okay, I want the GIMP. There was only the X11 version. It was awful. So I went looking and I found Seashore, which will read GIMP files, but it won't save them properly. So if you put a text layer, it will just rasterize it. And then the next time you open the file, it's become a bitmap layer. And that to me is just not practical if you're doing icons and logos and things. You need to be able to go in and edit the text afterwards. So I found Seashore to be kind of a bit of a toy app. So I was delighted then when the real OS 10 version of GIMP came along that didn't need X11.
Should we be unliabilist and a bit more forgiving and say that was some time ago, maybe? Or was it
certainly
yesterday?
Was some time ago.
It may have improved.
But I don't think there's a need for the app anymore, since there's now the native
GIMP, yeah.
Yeah, I think it sort of lost its raison d'etre.
Oh, well, fair enough. And Wheatley's gone.
Oh, dear.
Never mind. First question then. Dear Help Show, this is from John May. Dear Help Show, I've got an iMac 2008-20, 2.4 GHz Intel Core 2 Duo with 4 GB of RAM, new 320 hard drive and 1 terabyte and 500 GB external drives. Since upgrading to Mavericks, my machine has slowed down, spinning beach ball. I've received the limit of performance with this setup, I think. I have an analog job, so I only use my computer 3 days a week. Don't belong to a screen slave world. I also have iPad 2 and iPhone 5C. Looking forward after WWDC, should I look to upgrade my iPad or iMac as with the upgrading of Apple's software, some of my tech is falling behind. The main determining factor is cost, and making that choice so my tech will last. Please, Apple, slow down. That's not going to happen. All options gratefully appreciated. Yours sincerely, John May. Now, I think there's something else perhaps going on here, because certainly after Mavericks, my older machines really responded well to Mavericks, and the machines that you guys are on now, I had Snow Leopard on those, and I've updated them to Mavericks, and they're fine, and they're just Intel Core 2 Duo Mac Minis.
See, I'm quite shocked at this. I didn't think that a 2008 iMac would even take Mavericks, let alone...
I think it will, because I have a 2008 MacBook Pro like on the desk right back there, and it runs Mavericks perfectly fine.
It runs it very well.
Really think about it. For the last couple of years, the MacBook Pro and the iMac's basically been a MacBook Pro unfolded as far as specs go. And, you know, of course, there's slightly different logic boards, but the general specs have always been relatively identical. The only thing I see different in John May's setup versus what I have in a notebook back there is Mavericks in 4 gigs is not belong in the same sentence.
No.
Yeah.
So I would say head over to OWC. I don't know what is your, you know, if he's on that side of the pond, what is what your guys' equivalent of OWC is.
No, OWC is our equivalent of OWC. They rock. Oh,
yeah, you got Crucial as well. You got choices.
I can definitely tell you that that machine is going to tell you that it plops out at 8, but OWC will allow you to 16 gigs in. And the last I check, you're talking like 2-3 cases of beer total to cover 16 gigs of RAM on almost any Mac.
Yeah, yeah,
It was a 27-inch iMac. It was 2009, but it's got the same Core 2 Duo, and I've been running that with 16 gigs of RAM. Now I've now handed it on, so my parents are using it now. But that machine with Mavericks was perfectly happy to run the 20 apps at a time that I always run, and Aperture and all that kind of stuff, just as long as it had the RAM to do it. So as soon as I read the question, the 4 gigs of RAM just leapt out at me. It's like, no. You haven't reached the limit of performance of that setup, because 4 gigs of RAM is just too little.
I think there's an SSD option there as well. I mean,
I was going to say that definitely.
500 gig S. I mean, the one that Bart's on up here. There's a 2008 MacBook Pro up here, 17-inch screen. That's what Bart's on at the moment, and that has got a 256 SSD in it, and it's got 8 gig of RAM in it, and it flies. It's perfectly good. I could still use that as a production machine for work. It would take a bit longer to render stuff, don't get me wrong, but it still functions, and it's running Mavericks as well as. So I think SSD for a few quid, even if you just get a 128 or a 256, you're not going to be too far down on space. You've got external storage there for your swap files and that kind of stuff. You don't need to be too heavy on the internal drive. And as Doug says, I didn't realize you could get the 2008 iMac at 16 gig, though.
It's actually 6. That for some reason, that machine is topping out at 6. But I can still tell you that 4 is not it. 6 would help, but I don't know if it's going to help as much as maybe the SSD would.
Yeah, I think the SSD would make really a huge weird difference. That machine, and also, I think that one's got is it a FireWire 800, I think, in that model. That's off the top of my head. But they're certainly thinking about putting...
Sounds about right.
If they just bought like the cheapest SSD and then put the extra hard drive on a FireWire enclosure, just so they get that extra speed for the extra hard disk space, would probably be worthwhile.
Chat room's chipping in here. Bookery says, I've looked at the Mavericks and it's supposed to run on 2007 iMacs, so it should be fine. As long as you've got the App Store, aka you've got 10.6 Snow Leopard, you should be fine for upgrading. You should be able to get Riri Mavericks straight up from that anyway. Windrider's saying fresh install. I'm 50-50 on whether you should or shouldn't do fresh installs on stuff, but it can't hurt, I suppose.
Well, you should do them every couple of years anyway. Because I know people who have done the migration assistant since like 10.3. And at some stage, you do actually build up too much cruft for your own good, and you start to really slow all of your machines down because there's 20 million things loading up every time you boot. I wouldn't say do it every time, but you probably want to do it every 2 or 3 years at least.
Yeah, that goes for most operating systems.
Yeah, a point from Bookery as well. He's saying that the SSD won't make any difference unless you upgrade the RAM as well as. So,
yeah, because he's right. Because there's a little bit more of swapping. You just don't notice it because it's basically flash to flash swapping. So that's also correct. You know, the tough thing to me is, and I go through this a lot with clients. When you look at something like an iMac, Unfortunately, they are now built like a tank, so they normally outlast their actual usability, similar to us men. So
depends how sharp the knife is, mate.
One side of it, you're looking at it like, well, it's still working, so let me keep going. But every time you parlay that, you're making your situation get exponentially worse, especially knowing that there's a new OS popping out basically every year, and eventually they're going to slice you off. So even with Yosemite, I'm surprised when I look back that they didn't do too much of pruning on old hardware. But that being said, listening to the use case, I would possibly look at a mini. And yeah. Because by the time you add an SSD for $200 and you add the RAM for the other $120, you're halfway down a Mac Mini. And I would say pick up the last year's version of a Mac Mini on a refurb store for $500 is a better option. And you can get a screen for $150 at Costco or Sam's Club or whatever your warehouse club is. But that's going to put you far beyond the Core 2 Duo. You're talking about four processor upgrades since that Core 2 Duo came out, but you will be on par with what's current right now. And because we all feel there's a Mac Mini about to burst out of the balloon somewhere, if you'd set yourself a Google alert and know that there's an update coming within the next 1 to 2 months or so, you'll probably be able to get an end of life current model like the one I have sitting over here for around $500. And that would be like super win. And that's going to come with SSD and good RAM and the whole nine.
I think I mean, Wheaties will sell me out on this. I bought for the purposes of the Macworld trip. I bought myself a MacBook Air, and I maxed it out at the 11-inch. And everyone was like, no, you can't do Photoshop on that, and you can't do a Final Cut on that, and you can't do motion on it. I did all of those out in San Francisco. Never had a problem. It was fast. It was great. It was brilliant. i7 processor. Absolutely flew. And there's a certain element of me that I'm sitting thinking, well, a lot of places I go, there's a spare desk available and someone's got a VGA screen. I can take a Thunderbolt with me, plug into the VGA screen. I could probably get away with just running around with an 11-inch MacBook Air now. The video crunching, it's a little slower than my MacBook Pro, but it's not huge.
And for the occasional use that you're...
When it comes to techs...
Doc, just let Sarah in there because she's started.
I was going to say, and for the occasional... use where you're going to want to use it in that sort of environment, it's worth it for the benefit you're going to get from that, isn't it?
Yeah, excellent. Sorry, Doc, go ahead.
No, I was going to say there's two curses when it comes to tech. You're going to have what we call your muggles. They're going to go in and someone's going to tell them, oh, well, you're only doing Word and Internet Explorer, so you only need a small machine, right? And then the other end of that spectrum is, we're going to think, well, I'm a power user, so I need all of this. And so you're going to try to buy the most crazy, insane, fully loaded machine. And in both cases, you're wrong. The muggle needs a little bit more machine than he thinks, because unless you know how to do, the more your software needs to do for you, you actually kind of sort of need more power. And you're not going to be as versed in duct taping solutions the way we are. Mm. And us, we kind of normally overbuy our tech because we think we're going to get into Logic. And you get Logic and you spend about a week with it and you go, okay, going back to GarageBand. And then so now you have this beast of a machine that you're barely even putting a dent in the power. So I say it takes a little bit more thought when you're trying to spec out what you think you're not going to do, because what happens, technology changes and your mindset changes and you start wanting to do something that you didn't think you could. And now your machine can't do it. And you know what I mean?
Alternatively, build yourself a Hackintosh, which is what I did.
Roger that.
I've got a Hackintosh in my system here, and it cost me £600 to build, and it's Core i7 Haswell processor. And here's the best bit: the last three upgrades to Mavericks hasn't balked the EFI. It's just working, and it's upgrading itself. You haven't got to go for anywhere else. So your initial setup will have a problem, but
if you have to be, I don't know if that'll necessarily fit John May, because he doesn't seem like the kind of guy, based on what you said there, I'm assuming he's not the kind of guy that's going to create his own Hackintosh.
Yeah, but it's not as hard. I've got to say, if I can do it, Jesus.
It depends on how look at what your hardware, though, the Hackintoshing, because...
You can't buy
the hardware thinking you're going to Hackintosh, you'll probably do well, but if you have random hardware, it can be quite...
No, it's impossible. You go to Tony Mac 86 and just do it from that, and just use all these bootloaders and that kind of shit, and even I can do it. Mr. OII, what was that? Good answers. Excellent. Chat room's chipping in and having a bit of a dispute as well. I'm not going to read that out, though. Just thought I'd send you this in case. This is from Jim. You get a little thin on material for the help show. Thinking of us, Jim. It's kind of a commentary, if you like, on the 8.1 thing that we were talking about. I really wanted to be able to hibernate my tablet during long periods of inactivity. I find sleep is good if the tablet's constantly on and off, but over long periods of inactivity, i.e. overnight, the battery really drains. So for those times when you don't want to be constantly charging your tablet or don't have access to power, I find hibernating a good option, especially as it saves the state of all your open programs. I'm sure you know that. I've done a bit of Googling and found the attach post. I've modified it slightly for newbies and technically incompetents, and I've tested it on my Dell Venue 11 Pro running Windows 8.1, and it seems to work really great. Let me know what you think. Cheers, Jim. And I've got the article here completely, the retype stuff. I'm going to stick that up tomorrow as a blog post on the help blog. If you go to britishtechnetwork.com, you'll see two help show logos. So the help show logo that's under shows is the one where you get the video and the audio. But if you go down below in the blog section, then you'll get written posts from people that are how to do things. How to create a Thunderbolt bridge port, I wrote, and I think Paul's written a couple. Paulums has written a few as well, so we'll stick Jim's in there, and you can go and get those there. And if you've got any help questions that you want answered, you can either send them to britishtechnetwork@gmail.com, or you can go to our help community on Google+, post the question, and there's a whole community there that can help you. I think we've got quite a few people now in there, a couple of hundred. So you'll get answers to the questions that you've got. And a lot of the comments that we've got here tonight have come from the help community on Google+. So check it out. Give it a go. And also reviews as well. We've got no reviews in iTunes at the moment. We need some. Please give us some. Thank you. Next question. Dear Help Show, simple one, this one. Can you recommend a free or cheap WYSIWYG HTML editor for Mac OS X? All I want to do is create a simple HTML signature that I can use in Mail. Thanks, Ian in Cornwall.
So I have to say I've never used a free or cheap WYSIWYG HTML editor, primarily because with my job I generally need some of the meatier ones, and so I've never really looked into the free or cheap ones. However, I did a little bit of research this afternoon and I came across three options. Now, because I, as I've already said, I didn't really use them, I can't really vouch for any of them. These ones actually came from Tuwa, so I don't know if Doc has any knowledge of these, but these came up from the Tuwa blog, so I'm assuming they're relatively... tested and things like that. But one's Composer, written with a K and a Z, KOMPOZER.net. There's another one called cmonkey-project.org. That's from the guys who make Firefox. And the final one is w3.org/AMAYA/user/bindist.html. And those three are all free and apparently are quite good and probably would do exactly I've forgotten his name. Ian is probably what Ian needs there.
Brilliant.
Yeah, I must admit, I was a bit flummoxed by that as well, because like Paul, I mean, I don't use HTML editors at all now. I just use text editors because I got so fed up with the junk that most of them, the commercial products, actually put in there. So yeah. I struggled to think of one as well, because there wasn't one that jumped out at me.
No, I mean, I was trying to think, is there something like mainstream, like Apple or Microsoft or somebody like that do? But because Microsoft, I don't even know FrontPage still exists. I doubt it does, being that they've got Expression now. And of course, you have to pay for that as well. Well, of course, you have to pay for FrontPage, but you know. And of course, with iWeb going as well, but that's slightly different because it got outputted in a sort of funky format. It was HTML, but it put a whole bunch of extra cruft in there you didn't need, like Sarah said.
Like most of them do. I mean, the last one I used was Dreamweaver.
Yeah. So of course there's Dreamweaver as well, but there's a wee bit of price tag on that one. I mean, the other thing is to consider, you maybe don't want WYSIWYG. Consider just opening up like w3c.org. Is that the right URL? It's been a while since I've looked. And they have very, very, very basic tutorials on how to actually do HTML. If all you need it for is a signature, I'm assuming you're just looking for, you know, bold, maybe italic, font sizes, inline styles and things like that. And you'll probably be able to pick that up just on a few tutorials just around Google. And then you could just use text editors, as Sarah mentioned, on your Mac.
The other way to do it is if you actually have access to a content management system, might be WordPress or whatever, that you use for blogging or whatever, a lot of them will actually have the ability to type stuff in text and then actually get the HTML out of it. So if you're just using it for creating a signature file, you could do it like that and just not save the post.
Yeah, if you, some of them do funky things that with like p tags and things like that, don't they? So they don't actually put p tags in. They, even though you're switching to HTML, you just see the carriage returns. Yeah, I think WordPress does that. It doesn't actually put the p tags in, I think.
Mm. Yeah, because it treats two new line characters as like a filter when it's actually making the web page, so you wouldn't see those.
Yeah, so I mean, if you're wanting to kind of do what we mean by p tag, sorry, is carriage returns, like pressing the return key on your keyboard, so it kind of omits some of that kind of stuff. But I mean, you could still get around it. It is a really good shout. That would probably be able to do, just being aware of that though.
But if it's just a quick and easy HTML signature you need to do as a one off,
of course,
might be a quick and easy way to do it to save having to install yet another piece of software, or you know, use something completely different.
Great. Ian's question, duly answered. If you've got a question, BritishTechNetwork@gmail.com, we'll answer it. You can come to the chat room as well. We'll answer it there if it comes
up. What I was
going to
say one of the real simple tools, and I got to say, I'm with Paul here. Most WYSIWYG editors just put way too much rubbish in. So I gave that stuff up a long time ago and started doing the hand coding, which isn't that hard. Like he said, tons of free tutorials out there on university or YouTube. And also on Toots Plus Network. Anyway, check out this thing called Bootply. Bootply is a online WYSIWYG editor. So you don't even have to download any weird software that might throw, you know, like adware or whatever's into your machine. You can do it all from online because it's basically a forked version of Tiny MCE, which is going to what Sarah was saying, like in WordPress, you could open up a page, start using the Tiny MCE to make what you want, copy out the code, and then just never post that post. This gives you the exact same thing, but it's a little bit more sexy, and it's an online editor. It's called Bootply. There's a bunch of JavaScript playgrounds and HTML playgrounds. You can Google any of that, and you'll find great online editors that oftentimes will provide you with a little bit of drag and drop operability that you can then just use for your mail.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much, mate. Good answers. Next question. This is from Luke. Hi, Ewan. As a fairly new convert to Mac, I've been listening to the podcast for a few months now and just got to say, what a great job. Thanks very much, mate. And he enjoys it every week. I own a Mac Mini, but coming from messing about with Linux for many years, the info you give out on the show is really helpful. But please, can you help? As a professional Mac user, I have taken, I don't know if he's referring to me there or not, but okay. I've taken a role as a membership secretary in a club, but all the docs and sheets are in MS Office formats. I have only used for many years open software, so I use LibreOffice on the Mac, which suits my little bit of stuff. But when opening Microsoft in this, I've been having issues with formatting problems and compatibility too, and I think you're going to get that in anything that you pick almost, unless you buy the home version. So the question is, can you recommend the use of iWork, or do I need to bite the bullet and pay much, much more for the Office for the iMac? Any help you offer would be great. Cheers, Luke. You're going to get formatting issues, though, regardless. So things like content sheets and stuff like that, they are completely balked across both platforms anyway. And even I've had conflict issues when I've used Microsoft Office for Mac with ones that have been created in DocX or something like that. But anyone else?
Yeah, I agree. Even if you're using Word on both platforms, issues. So I would say don't throw the money away at the Office 365 subscription. If all it is formatting issues, I don't really know if there's any way around that, to be honest. It's mainly in tables and things like that from memory. It's been a while since I've used Word on the Mac. But generally, when I did use it previously, it was how tables kind of got formatted and things like that. Everything else generally was okay, with maybe some padding issues here and there.
Clean text tends to be okay, but it's when you get into Excel spreadsheets, you can get corruptions on those because there's so many things that don't translate.
Well, and PowerPoint is terrible at converting over.
Well, it just doesn't work.
Like, it's already, that's not already a surprise, really, considering what it does.
He was speaking about having to buy iWorks. And one thing to remember, at this point in time, the iWorks softwares are free. So that oftentimes can help. But I find TextEdit does perfectly well on the document parts. And for the non-document parts, open Google Docs.
Yeah, definitely Google
by
Docs.
Non-documents, yeah. I'm sorry, that was a bad way to put it. For the Word style, word processing documents, you can use TextEdit or Google Docs. But for the other things like your spreadsheets and your presentations and whatnot, use Google Docs. It does a beautiful job. The things that don't convert properly, again, there's some great online file converters. And this just came up because somebody wrote in and was asking me on my show about AppleWorks. Like, they had all these AppleWorks documents, and two came to mind. One is called Zanzimar. It has dumb ads. You got to ignore that, but it does work really, really well. And the other one is called Convert Files. Both of them are at a .com. Zanzimar is Z-A-M-Z-A-R, Zamzar.com, and Convert Files as well, ConvertFiles.com. And they both do excellent jobs of doing a little bit more, you know, clean conversion, equivalent to that old thing we had back in OS 9, which I totally forget the name of. It might have been File Converter.
Fair enough.
Well, one of the I use LibreOffice on Linux and Office on Windows 7, and I do have some issues between the two. But one of the ways I found to get around this, but this applies to Word and Excel and their equivalents in LibreOffice, is if I found compatibility problems if I create a document in LibreOffice, which is then saved in a Microsoft format and then opened in Microsoft, you might get more likely to get issues. But I've discovered that if you actually originate the document in the Microsoft version, then it and it saves that originally, that after that it's fine. I've never had any problems.
Right.
So that might be a way around any problems. Obviously it's not going to avoid the formatting issues. Those are going to occur anyway, but that may, there seem to be some, I've discovered some issues between compatibilities, particularly for the spreadsheet and the
It's definitely tables and shit and spreadsheets that cause most of the issues.
Yeah,
but originating them in Word to start Word and Excel to start with seems to avoid the problems that I have had in the past.
The one thing I would say is that you've taken on a role to help a membership secretary as a part of a club. But the one thing that clubs are notoriously good at is hiding the amount of funds that they've got. So get the tight-ass bastards to buy you something that will actually do the job. I remember being part of a club, and I won't say who they are, but everyone was crimping around and saving and trying to keep money in and, you know, save stuff here and there and everywhere. And it turned out they got 28 grand in the bank.
Experienced that as well.
Get the treasurer drunk one night and you'll get yourself a brand new copy of Home Office for Mac.
I've been a membership secretary of a theatre production company before, and one of the things I found invaluable for doing just about everything, newsletters, thing, is a complete copy of Office, because especially the version with access, because that really helps for doing mail merge and stuff like that properly, and keeping control of mailing lists.
It might be worth it. I mean, 365 sounds like a pretty good option, because you can only get what you need.
I work at Google Docs. I think Google Docs does almost everything you would ever need. I mean, I don't know what this guy is going to be doing on a day-to-day basis for this club, but Google Docs does everything. It's very rare that I have to open up pages or numbers or anything like that anymore, because absolutely everything's there. It's everywhere I need it. And the great thing is, because it's a club, it means that they could give access to the, you know, all the board members and things like that, so that they could all go in. They could have maybe read-only access, so they could just jump in and see, you know, where the accounts are or where, you know, the membership or whatever he needs to do. And they can do it collaboratively as well.
That's true.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah,
it's good. Good
point. You know, one other thing real quick, I think is kind of neat to know. There is a slight advantage to going to the iWorks, which is probably going to get a name change soon, my crackpot theory, is if you use iWorks and you are also an iOS person, you're going to get to play with Handoff.
Mm. That's true.
So that's going to be bonus points all day. And again, anybody in the club that buys a new device, they're going to get it free. I won't say that it's probably legal, but there's easy ways to liberate that. If the bot is like only a year and a half old, mine was 6 months away from the time they announced the free. And I just called Apple tech support and talked to them for a minute, and they ended up giving me redemption codes. So I was able to get iWorks for my Mac. So, you know, depending on how long ago you bought that Mac Mini, you might be able to get iWorks for free with a simple phone call to Apple, because they don't really care. They're not making money off of selling you the $15.
It's only $10 anyway. So, you know, if you decide that actually you'd like a word processor with a nice UI, a tenner for Pages isn't exactly excessive, right?
No, not at all. Not for what it can do.
Thank you, Doc, for taking...
being able to get to that handoff thing. And I have to say something to
Ewan
that I thought was really funny. He was talking about membership. I just got onto our local Hawaii Mac users group on their board. And here I'm thinking they're complaining because, you know, they need to get membership up. But yet, the same token, nobody wants to add new members because they're afraid all the young people are going to come and take over. Let's just say the average age is 70 until I got there. And we're looking at the budget and they're like, well, we did this event only made like $200. And I'm like looking at those numbers like, wow, this is paltry. Get down to the bottom line. Sure as grits is grocery, bro, there's close to $70,000 in the bank.
Yeah. You see what I'm saying? you know, like,
holy crap.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you, Doc, for introducing illegality to the Help Show. You've now taken us from the Help Show to the Know What I'm Saying Show.
It's not a help. It's not illegal because, again, if you call them and you tell them your situation, they'll probably give you a redemption code. I promise. I've seen it done many times.
Thanks, man. Sol I am says, I must admit that 365, as I run it on my email, is good. I use Office on my VMs. Also, an existing subscriber, when the new Mac updates came out for Word, Excel, and Outlook, I get them free. It's really good value, in my humble opinion. Sarah, you say?
I was just about to say, one thing I would say, it's a slightly non-technical issue, but it is a legal point of view from someone who's been a membership secretary, is when I took that role over, I discovered that the person who had been using Access, using our Office, was using their own copy. So we had to buy our own copy. So to avoid that doing again, make sure that you actually, whatever you do, you do the name of the organization rather than personally.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of places. It's a good point. The legality of it is accurate. Yeah, absolutely.
That's good. Interesting. I didn't know that. My kind of local fair committee and stuff like that years ago, and we all used our own software. So technically that was against the license.
Absolutely. No. It's not so much that. It's just that if when you pass on that role, if you've got data stored in that format and the person you're passing it to doesn't have access to that software, it means you have to buy yet another copy of the software.
Of course, yeah. Sorry, yeah. That's,
whereas
yeah.
you can pass on the copy, yeah. Deactivate.
Yeah, exactly.
What's happening on the 12th of July? Well, I hope you're coming to the bash. If you want to come to the curry on the 11th of July, I wouldn't dick around too long because there's not many tickets left, unfortunately. The curry is on the 11th of July. It's a £10 deposit. You pay us a £10 deposit. You get the £10 back on the night to settle the bill. It'll all come off. We've got the Kismet Curry House here in Birmingham. It's at B36 is the postcode. So any hotels that you want, get in that kind of area. The taxi services around here, TC Cars, is really, really good. So it's not too expensive. But the Kismet Curry House is the best curry house in the world, no question, and you'll get the finest Indian food there. There's beer served as well, which is great, and the fantastic company that'll be coming with it will see you through. That's on the 11th, and then on the 12th, all day, we've got the Link at Waterholm where we were last year. I've got to pay for that tomorrow, and that is now ours, and we've got to fill it. So please buy a bash ticket, get yourself up here. It is a family day. Someone said to me on Monday night, I went down to the London Mac user group, and they said, oh, well, okay, but, you know, we're not really geeks. No, it's not a geeks day. It's a family day. It's a bit of fun and talking with people who just love talking about technology and talking about all kinds of fun stuff. Last year, we had space opera races. We had the World Card Cutting Championships. And we've actually got some far better games this year. Balloons will be involved and ladies' tights will be involved, I promise you. So... get yourself up for the bash. It's a fun family day out. It is not a tech geekery day. We've all got our tickets, all of us here, apart from Doc and Bart, of course, because they're overseas. But Greeny's coming. Don McAllister's coming. All the people from last year. Don McAllister actually pulled a muscle on the space hopper race last year. And was quite bad for a while, which is why I'm laughing so hard. So, Don, get well soon, mate. I think he's still crook. Right, next question. It's actually in the chat room. Question from Chris Kempion. He and I know that Weezer's has got a vested interest in this answer.
I really do.
What is the panel's recommendation for effective home storage? I currently got a desktop, a 1 terabyte drive, Western Digital, and I back up to CrashPlan. Thinking of buying a NAS with DNLA iTunes server compatibility and ideally Wi-Fi, but ensure of the best setup. Now, you've lost yours recently, haven't you, mate?
Did I lost mine?
I told and that was a week after I told you,
so it was all good.
Well, I told you not to trust NAS, didn't I? I did say don't trust NAS.
Oh no, I have no problem. I am really, really happy that my new NAS came, stuck the new hard drives in, and everything was awesome, as the Lego movie says. but I absolutely love it. The one thing to maybe raise a little flag there is a lot of people kind of go with this iTunes server thing, thinking it's going to move their TV and movies and stuff like that. But generally, the NASes that support these iTunes servers are just for your music. And they just share your music library. It's not actually your TV shows and movies. So be very, very wary of that. I used to have a trouble. Didn't like it. I didn't like the software that you had to run on your machine. The software was clunky. It had to always run in the background. You were doing things. You had to remember to shut down that software before you did anything. Now, to be fair, it wasn't a Drobo N, so it wasn't the networking one. But I got a Synology NAS, and I have to say I love it. Now, notwithstanding the fact that a lightning strike came through my telephone line and took out my NAS, including 2 TVs, 2 Skyboxes, and a router as well, and the little filter thing exploded in my living room too. Not as bad as the house that the lightning actually hit. It's having to be leveled because it's completely destroyed the house, and the house is only about 4 years old. Anyway, that's another story. I would go with a Synology NAS myself. Absolutely superb. I've had no problems with them at all.
What's the price on those?
Native Plex. It's got native iTunes server. But bear in mind, most NASes will not do TV and movies in your iTunes library.
What was the cost of that, Paul?
That was about 500 quid, I think.
SAN drives.
Without the drives, yeah. But a Drobo was going to be about the same price.
Yeah,
Drobo was way cheaper now.
Yeah, about a year ago now, I was sort of, I used to like sprout external hard drives, and eventually I just looked at my desk one day and went, there are 8 drives plugged on my desk here. This cannot scale. And so I said, I know, I'll buy a Drobo. And then I went to the Drobo website, looked at the price, and went, no, it won't. And I ended up sort of taking the nerdy route out, which is I bought a case that was the biggest tower I could find that was like €30, stuck a cheap motherboard into it, cheap processor, tiny little bit of RAM, Linux onto it. There's now 10 hard disks in it, and it works an absolute treat.
Yeah. I've got to say, I've only had one experience with Drobo, and I got my money back on it.
Yeah,
I lost photos.
I built my own NAS as well in a very similar way. Using an old Linux box and attached all the drives to it. It works a treat.
Doc, you were saying?
If you're technically inclined, a small computer case, a cheap computer case and free NAS will do really, really well. But I want to do a little defending of Mark and the people at Drobo. First of all, they dropped their prices immensely, right? So a 4-bay USB 3 Drobo now is $350, which is super cheap.
Well, that might be an Atlantic issue though, mate, because we get different prices over here from you guys.
This might be true. But they literally during Macworld, a month before Macworld, they dropped all the prices on everything by like $150. So there's one. The other thing is they've recently changed the way that the Drobos interact. So they no longer need to have that desktop client running. That was more a situation of the old hardware that was available to these boxes versus the new hardware. A lot of that stuff is handled either through the USB 3 bus or through the Thunderbolt now. So you really don't need to use that software. It's just a visual thing so that you can know how much space and stuff is there, but totally not necessary. And to answer the question in the chat room, I have a transporter right now. And it's not really a NAS, so I won't put you down that track. Say about transporter is I have a massive love-hate relationship with it. I love it because it's really easy to just move stuff off my computer and know that it's safe on the other side of the room. And if I need to get something while I am away, I can open up my iOS device, open up my laptop, I can grab something. It's kind of like roll your own Dropbox. The thing I hate about the transport is going back to what Paul said about the whole Trovo. The application occasionally comes on and runs my processor at 180% for no reason whatsoever because I'm not syncing anything. And they just updated it. That didn't fix anything. But that part of it kind of chaps my nads, and you can't see it without the desktop software. So there's that. I would say
it's scary.
Not quite baked yet. Drobo is still a good option. Best option, free NAS. Build it yourself.
Which bit of that? The drop, the chaff in his nads? No, was that?
Yeah.
Good man.
In my nads.
Price of a Drobo DRD 5 bay desktop NAS storage device is £347. So that's like $500 here.
Yeah. So look at Drobo, the 4 bay one, the new 4 bay USB 3.
4-bay desktop DAS enclosure is 279.
Yeah, so that should come out to 350.
The R Mini, yeah, about that, a bit more, yeah. Well, that's yeah. VAT included as well, though, don't forget. So it's probably a little bit, it's probably exactly on, yeah. Maybe even a show cheaper.
I really like this analogy. I totally get what all you guys are saying, and I think they're all really good options. I looked at a bunch of different options. I tested out Drobo. I had a Drobo for a couple of years, but I sold it on eBay to buy the Synology NAS. I got the DS412 Plus. It was actually based on a recommendation by Dave Hahn. And the other thing over the back of that is I use a crash plan as well to back everything up, which is kind of, well, I was kind of worried when the whole Lightning thing happened, and it was it kind of saved me a little bit, so it's
and
all
you,
good.
And you didn't buy a PSU?
Sorry?
You didn't buy a power backup or anything like that with surge protection? And
of course I did, but it's Lightning, man.
Yeah, but it still should
stop it.
The surge protection should stop it.
No, it's yes, Lightning. It does. That stops surges coming through the power line. It's Lightning. Jeez. The house that actually got taken out had surge protectors in every plug. I have surge protectors in absolutely every plug, including the ones. Also, to remember, the Lightning bolt came down the telephone, not the power line. And I actually have the surge protectors that have the telephone ports in them as well. I thought I was secure up to the hilt. But no, yeah. It's a Lightning. It just came straight through, just ignored it and carried on.
APC.com. That's the one you want. That's what I've got. I've got a spare one now. You can have this one.
I had a similar situation where I had a scanner that was taken out mid-scan in the middle of a Lightning storm. And it was because it was a all-in-one
did
device.
Did it burn what was on the platen as well? Just for good measure?
No, it didn't. But the actual scanner actually literally was rock solid halfway through the document. And the reason why it did that was not because of the power, but like Paul said, because of the phone line, because it was an all-in-one device and it had a fax machine in it, so it was connected to the phone socket.
If you get one of the power supply ones, they should cut off any surge protection, whether it's Lightning or otherwise, through your electrical system, because it's only going through your earth leakage.
The ones I prefer for surge protection, for two reasons, are the Belkin ones. Two reasons. Firstly, because most of them have got phone, so you can put the phone through them as well. And secondly, because in the UK, and I haven't managed to find it over here yet or not, but in the UK, they give you free, up to I think it's about £35,000 protection, that if you're using it and it takes out a device, their insurance policy will pay for your equipment to be replaced.
Spot on.
Yeah, the APC ones are really good. And I was using, I don't think it's an APC one, I can't remember, but it's definitely a battery backup one. And the main reason I got it actually was because it was handy to have an extra battery backup when Ava was really little and we were getting a lot of power cuts. And so I thought having that extra battery would be really handy if we ever had a power cut and so I can still like warmer milk and things like that. So I definitely have one of them and the Lightning went straight through it. Every house in the street was affected in some way. The Sky van pretty much took up residence in the street here for about a week, just fixing everybody's skyboxes and dishes and everything like that. It was pretty scary.
I've got three of those, and one of them's faulty, and it goes off in the middle of the night, and I end up getting out of bed. Just once every 6 weeks or something like that, it just goes off. It works apart from that, though. Surge protection works. Anyway, next question. Dear Help Show, I'm not a power user for Linux, but I've heard lots about it and I've enjoyed messing around until Wednesday. That made me laugh this afternoon. It's still making me laugh. I don't know why. My Windows machine went into a loop and kept restarting, so I was forced to repair the installation using the recovery tool. On restarting the machine, everything was fine with the Windows installation, but I have no ability to dual boot anymore. I can't get into the Linux distro at all. All I know is data is there, but I can't start the OS. Can you help me, please? Sarah, you are our Linux girl. Start us off.
I think Bart's answered this one in the show notes really, really well. Basically, what's happened is when you've repaired Windows, it's overwritten the bootloader, allows you to dual boot. And the way to avoid, because unlike Linux, which takes account of other operating systems that might be there, Windows just thinks, hey, the world is Windows, so why would I have to think about anything else? But I think that probably the quickest and easiest way to get around that is to, if you've got your Linux disk or even the ISO file, is to reboot it from that. And it should actually then, when you either reinstall it or repair it, it should actually reinstall the bootloader so that once you then boot it again, it will actually see both operating systems.
Is this the grub?
It is the grub, yes. But
I'm not totally stupid.
Well, it's the grub or Lilo if you want to get picky.
All right, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, give me a break. I had to Google that this afternoon.
There are other ways of getting around it, but they're more technical. But that is, as Bart, I think, suggested, is probably the quickest and easiest way to do it.
Yeah, excellent. I mean, I did Google it this afternoon myself, and there was a command line that was suggested of sudo something or other grub boot.
But you can't boot into Linux. Linux command is unlikely to help them out.
I don't know.
The best way is to let the loader, the bootloader that's going to would reinstall. I don't want to scare the person who's asked and say it's going to overwrite the Linux. But if you actually go through that repair process, it should actually sort the boot out, because it will actually take account of the fact that other operating systems are on there.
I think as well, before they try that, I'd maybe look into creating a kind of a little mini USB drive with Linux on it.
Sorry?
He was just going to say that. Carry on.
It's a 128 gigabyte USB 3 stick, but these things are so cheap. It's like $50 on Amazon now. So it has Mavericks, Yosemite, Linux, all on different partitions on this guy.
Yeah.
Yep. And then if you boot off that, then it'll allow you access the hard drive just to put a backup of all your data before you do what Sarah was suggesting there, just to be on the safe side. So you've definitely got a backup of your data before you possibly make a mistake and overwrite it for whatever reason.
I just love the fact that you guys were all about to correct a bloke who can barely make a page in iWeb. So...
Well, just this is actually one of the most common things that happens when you start the Linux dual booty stuff, and it's happened to me many times over the years. And I mean, I was using Fedora, but I'm sure all the other Linux distros are the same. When you go to reinstall them and say, oh, look, I see a Linux distro over here. How's about I fix that one? You go, sure. And it'll just rewrite the bootloader, put it back there. And again, because Linux is a good citizen, it has a look around. Oh, what else is here? Oh, well, I best make that accessible. And then everything's back the way it was. It's just Windows just go stomp, stomp, stomp. Mine. How dare you run something else?
You think by now they would actually... been a bit more friendly about it.
Yeah, right.
You would. I think, Sarah, yourself and myself are sort of around the same conclusion. Avoid dual booting if you can.
Yeah.
And
virtually rocks. Yeah. Bronwyn in the chat room has just sent you to howtogeek.com/how-to/ubuntu/reinstall-ubuntu-grub-boot-loader-after-windows-wipes-it-out.
That's a good title.
with hyphens between each one. Hyphens in.
The one thing I would say to Kevin, though, who's the chap who's actually asked the question, is beware when you actually are doing the repair, because as someone just said, it will actually notice it, and that there is an easy temptation to just add yet another partition. What you've got, you've actually got to make sure you pick the one that's already there, so that you don't end up with yet another partition with yet another install of Linux in there.
Spot on. Thank you very much. Jason's written in, just to let you know, an amazing app on the Mac App Store that completes all the data and images to ripped DVDs from Handbrake and makes iTunes an absolutely amazing library. It's filmtagapp.com. Have a go at it. See if you can find it and have a go. There you go. Filmtagapp.com. Thanks, Jace, for sending that in. Much appreciated. Next question from Kevin's done. Next one's from Jace again. I'm having problems connecting iPad, Retina, and Air to home sharing. Circle goes halfway and stops. Apple TV Gen 3 is fine, and using Air Video HD and Plex all go, so router not the issue. Libraries mostly rip CDs and DVDs, approximately 160 GB media. I'm running a 27-inch iMac mid-2011 with 2TB and 12GB of RAM and updating Mavericks. And most recently, I'm on iOS 7. Seems an issue as Apple forums have people complaining quite a lot. Any suggestions? I've got to say, I find home sharing to be one of the most annoying things Apple. I mean, I've got content, I've got 600 DVDs that I've ripped myself and put on my servers, and I've only got five machines that can play them. I've got 25 Macs in this house. So, I mean, I'm not exaggerating.
I don't think you can immediately shoot the router down as being the issue just because Plex and AirVideo HD work. There's all sorts of different things there. Now, I don't know a huge bit about networking, but I had a similar issue, and I just had to dig about in my router settings, and I finally got it working, but I wouldn't even like to hazard a guess as to how I eventually got it working, because it was a case of just kind of clicking on a few things and hoping it worked for the best. The other element could be it's quite a big, not huge, but it's quite a big library. Perhaps set up a new library that's maybe only got one song in it, see if that makes a difference on a different machine. Could have something to do with that. I mean, there's so many variables here that it'd be very difficult to just kind of say do this and that'll work. I think it's a case of just trying them one at a time, perhaps trying over a cabled connection. I know it's obviously an iPad that he's talking about there, but trying it with like a laptop connecting through a wired connection, see if Wi-Fi is causing the problem. There's lots and lots and lots of things here that could be causing the issue.
It's sort of something to bear in mind if you have a slightly complicated home network setup. Maybe you have a router and you have a wireless access point or something. A lot of these protocols rely on broadcast traffic, which means if you accidentally have two routers both in routing mode, they're going to act as a barrier to any of that kind of traffic. And so you need to be really careful that I'm trying to find a way to say this without being nerdy, but I'm not going to succeed. It has to be on the same IP subnet or it will not work.
And the second one has to be in bridge mode as well.
Yeah, so if you have two, you make one of them bridge, because that way it's one IP network across your whole home network. So this isn't about the physicality of your network. It's about the logic of your network.
Right.
And you can't go into
IP networking in 5 minutes.
Doc has his hand raised. Dude, you don't need to put your hand up.
Because this is I'm going to harken back to my Genius Bar days, and let me explain this to you. You might need a pen. You need 36896207874915253353. Open all of those ports and your problem goes away. Because what happens is there are a handful of essential ports. And what Apple did is there's different ports used based on the file type that's coming at it. That way the Apple TV can kind of discover like what's the right file and work into the right codecs and all of that. So there's a list of ports that if you have any problems, these should happen automatically. But if you don't, if you are having a problem, you can use an application like Nmap or what is the other one called? Dabuki or something. And it will let you see when you try to play them what port is being pinged. And you might just have something that's just monkeying up that port. So by opening up these ports in your Apple utility, then you're saying, okay, I know this is going to work. And 9 times out of 10, whenever I've had to solve this problem for a customer, there is some crazy, hokey protection thing that they added, like NetNanny or, you know, some virus blocking software on their Windows kit that just ate the ability for this to happen. So open the ports.
Doc, tomorrow morning I'm going to sit and listen back to this, and I'm going to pause and rewind and pause and rewind and pause and rewind until I get every single one of those damn ports.
Give you the port numbers in the list. How about that?
Do it, dude. Let me publish this as a show note, so that's grand. Fantastic answer. I like that one a lot. Yeah. Well done.
Yeah. And if you need a quick way to remember this, just type this into your Google. Home sharing, essential ports. That's the key thing. If you just look for home sharing essential ports, you'll find a whole bunch of people that have discovered the same thing I just told you.
Go on, Paul.
So, Doc, you just ruined the magic. I thought you had all those at the top of your head. And actually, you just read them out after Googling that phrase.
Yeah. That's why he had his hand
No, it's in Evernote because it happens all the time. So, yeah, not the top of my head, but Evernote is technically the top of my head circa 2014. Yeah. So, yeah.
I've got to say, I've got a Mac Mini over at the far end of the office there that's linked up to a couple of multi-bay drives. And I've got major problems at the moment with the Apple TVs going to home sharing, seeing the stuff that's on there. And when I go into the computers on Apple TV interface, it shows up the computer and it shows up all the iPad, all the artwork for all of the things. But as soon as you click on it, it says no content. And it's absolute bull because the drive's running, iTunes is seeing it, there's nothing going wrong, and it's just a pain in the arse. I hate sharing my iTunes library with Mac TV. It's the worst experience.
The best way
on
to
Apple.
Do that is seriously Plex, man. Like Plex, yeah, totally, totally works. And what's really cool about that is they're so easy to build things that run Plex. There's Raspberry Plex, there's Chromecast Plex server. Mm. There's my Mac Mini is what my Plex server is here. And it works flawlessly. The dope part about Plex as well is when I'm in the office pretending to work, I open up Plex on my iPhone or my iPad. I have full access to everything. And I have over 1,500 movies in Plex and a DJ's library worth of iTunes. And when I'm even in San Fran, like I pull up a Plex and we're watching movies instead of paying for the hotel thing.
We'll talk. Next question. I got to say, this one struck a chord with me because this is something that I've noticed as well. Is it me or is the preferred DNS something which more and more Wi-Fi providers are almost insisting on to the exclusion of an open DNS? I have my own DNS settings for home and my Virgin Media system prefers a 194 address, but when I'm sharing my iPhone internet connection, it spits and hisses at me and I need to reconfigure to use something like Google Open DNS. Then when I get to the cloud on my MacBook Pro, I don't even get me started. Well, please don't even get me started on trying how to connect there. I found a guy next to me at the pub recently. He gave me a 10-dot DNS that the cloud prefers. Otherwise, I don't think I'd have got on even still. And the list of places goes on and on. I know this is a rant more than a question. So is there anything out there that can assist me or typical settings I can present, etc.? Remembering the network just doesn't seem to cut it anymore. Regards, Ed Burns.
DHCP, that's what it's for. Put it back to auto. I say put it back to auto, but in your home, right? Don't change your laptop. Don't change your Mac. Change your router. And then while you're at home, your devices are all set up to auto, but they're automatically being want at home. Then as soon as you leave home, you have no customizations. Your machine is completely au naturel and it will just work on people's networks and you're going to have way less headaches and you're going to get right what you want.
Well,
however, that only works so far. So I agree in principle, but if you are perhaps, I can't think of a scenario, but perhaps you're using a DNS address that maybe, I don't know, gives you the illusion that you're in a different country for one reason or another, your bank will detect that potentially and will throw up a fit. And potentially put all sorts of fraud crap on your account if you're trying to access your online banking and they think that you're in the States or you're in Canada or you're in the Ukraine or something like that because your DNS is there. So be very careful with that.
No, but they don't know where your DNS is coming from. You reach out to a DNS server to turn their network address into an IP. You reach out to their IP. They have no idea who resolved that address for you.
No, I've tested this when I was, because I've been working for banks and changing your DNS causes all sorts of funny little things.
Well, let me just go back a bit, because when I was at university doing my law degree, I had a problem that my Mac wouldn't get on the network at all. And I went to the IT department and they said, put this DNS in. And I put their DNS in and all of a sudden I've got an IP and it's working. And I know the cloud as well, because what this guy's saying I've done I went in to see a guy. I couldn't get on the cloud at all where I was. And then a guy next to me, I said to him, what's the cloud IP? And he gives me the 10 dot IP that there is. And the cloud will suddenly let me in on my Mac. And there's a certain part of it, you know, that makes me want to do the kind of Shaggy impression and go, is it because I is Mac that people don't want me to do stuff? But this is not just a case of clicking to DHCP, because I've gone to DHCP and I still don't get on the cloud. There is something about you have to have the DNS that they want pre-specified, or that they're not going to let you in if you're Mac.
There's something funny going on there. It's like that in unis here, all over the place. And one of the most common questions I get from customers calling in is they're having problems at the uni, and I got to give them the uni, you know, the IP address, or for the DNS address, and it totally works. And before, we used to use OpenDNS a lot at the university to get around, you know, the blocks. So if you're in, like, I don't know, poli sci class and you're bored, you got your headphones in, you're trying to watch a little Spanktor vision on the back of the table, you wouldn't be able to get in because it's like, oh, this is blocked, or you can't play, you know, Minecraft or whatever. And all you would have to do is go to 8.8.8.8 and you're good to go. But now it doesn't work. They figured it out. The guys that graduated with my class figured out what we used to do, and now they all work at the uni, so they block the other DNS. So you have to
Where did the hell did you get Spanktor vision from as a phrase?
Well, because it's the television that, never mind.
Yeah, moving on. Jesus. Yeah. We got some show titles tonight.
Obviously something that was going on when he was at college.
Absolutely. Bart, you're going to say?
I can't remember what I was going to say. Oh, wait, if you're blocking stuff based on, like, if you think that you as a person running a network are having any effect on people by using DNS to block, you're an idiot, because all DNS does is turn names into IP addresses. If you actually want to block stuff, you need to block the IP addresses they're going to, not the name resolution. But the amount of people who rely on this sort of security by obscurity, if we just make the DNS network, we'll have control over our network. I mean, that's just stupid.
Well, yeah, but
we're talking
but
about as university,
an
right?
As an end user.
I work in a university as a sysadmin. We're not all dumb.
No, but Bart, as an end user, I go to the cloud and I'm sat in a pub or I'm sat in a hotel and I've got the cloud as my option and I'm sitting there going, come on, let me on. No, it won't let me on. Forget about specifying a manual address, mate. I'm on DHCP, but it will not let me do anything until I put in the DNS that it wants.
The thing is, though,
you're misconfigured then, because the whole point of DHCP is that DHCP tells your machine what DNS server to use. If their DHCP isn't specifying their DNS server, their network is misconfigured.
If you've got your own DNS specified on your system, even if you go to the DHCP setting, then it still wants all of those deleted first before it even gives a chance.
Yes.
And even then, it doesn't.
When I say turn off manual DNS, you've got to take them out. You've got to let DHCP put them in.
Yeah. The other thing is, Ewan, is that it can't be, you said, is it because I is on a Mac? It can't be, because networking is not specific. It might be something to do with the cloud.
No,
it's certainly nothing to do with the Mac. You could be connecting to the
OS,
cloud,
mate,
from something else.
No, because when I was at university,
a Mac address.
I'm stupid, but I'm not that stupid.
If you have hard-coded DNS, your Mac will ignore the DNS that was given by DHCP, even if it's using DHCP for your IP address. Yeah. If you actually want proper DHCP behavior on a Mac, those hard-coded DNS servers have to come out.
Right, thank you. But when I was at uni, I knew damn well that, I mean, I had a Windows machine when I first started at uni that I took in because I knew I was having problems.
Was it around then?
Sorry?
Was Windows around then?
You asshole. Yeah, there was me carrying me PowerBook 100, bastard. And I used a Mac, and the Mac would not let me on. The Windows machine would connect instantly. The Mac wouldn't let me on at all, and it was purely because it was Mac.
OS pre-10.
I think they were just wankers.
Because TCP/IP, which is the basis of the networking, is non-discriminate to operating systems, so it can't be. It must have been something in the setting.
Everyone who had a Mac
suggested, unless there was something in the Mac. In the Mac address or something that actually
was discriminatory.
This is because if this is before OS X, then Apple had their own protocol they preferred over TCP. You had Apple Talk.
Ah, I see. Right. So okay,
we're predating the ubiquity of TCP. It used to be the case that Windows machines talked...
you cheeky bastard, BlueShots. It was 10.
Apple machines talked Apple Talk, and the two wouldn't work together. But since OS X and since Windows has grown up, everyone has settled on TCP/IP, and now life is great.
Yeah, that was it. It was the vagaries of using System 3 at university. You bastard, shut up. Piss off. It was System 10, all right?
Okay, he says it was a stone tablet.
Yeah, bollocks. Next question, moving on. Jesus Christ. Dear Home Show, I have a disc stuck in my Mac Mini. The disc shows an image. I shouldn't laugh. The disc shows as an image in Disk Utility and not a CD-ROM. And when I start the machine, I hold down the mouse button, but nothing comes out. I'm pretty sure I'm not going mad, and there is a disc inside. But nothing I do short of shoving a knife in the slot will give me a positive indication that something's there. Ideas. P.S. 160-mile round trip to an Apple store is not an option. Thanks, Adam in Colorado.
Well, okay, first step, right? If there's a disc in there, when you go to push another disc in, it won't fit. So no need for knives. Just take another disc and try stick it in. If it doesn't go in, you are correct. You are not mad. There is genuinely a disc in there.
Right. Then,
it depends on your model of Mac Mini then, because there is somewhere a little magic place that if you stick a paperclip, it will come out. I had to do it on my own Mac Mini years ago, but it's different on different Mac Minis, depending on whether they have a little IR sensor next to the disk drive and stuff. So you may have to do some Googling, but there really is one in there. There is a magic place where you take a paperclip, you unwind it, and you shove it in, and it will come out. Because what I did was I stuck, you know those little mini CDs that are smaller than a real CD? I just shoved one of those into my Mac Mini.
And did it work?
Oh, God, no, it got stuck horribly.
I've got some of those, and I only use them in the trays.
Do you know how I got it out?
Go on.
I held the machine sideways and shook.
Good lad.
And it did come out, and all was well. But I felt like such an idiot.
The
paperclip thing, there's not a Mac user on the planet that doesn't have one of these sitting on a desk somewhere, because we just have them. Even though we barely use them anymore, it's just always handy. But another secret that we used to do at the Genius Bar is I put my business cards away yesterday, but what we used to do is take two business cards, right? It helps if you have Mood card because they're a little bit thicker. You take two business cards and you go like that. And while it's spinning, what you can do when you first boot, because it's trying to load it, you feel it till you bite the side of the CD and you go one up. And then you feel it again till you bite the side of the CD and you go one down. Squeeze it to right there and then press the reboot it again, holding the mouse. Right when it attempts to do the shiggy shake, you pull it and it'll pop right out.
Okay.
I've done that thousands of times. And people at the Genius Bar would just freak out because they would come in and the pre-unibody machines, people would carry their machine around school like this, not realizing that you're slowly smashing the puka, sorry, Hawaiian word translation, slowly smashing the hole so that the disc wouldn't come out. And so black plastic MacBooks, white MacBooks, and pre-unibody MacBook Pros always got closed on that side from people walking around holding their machine with one hand. And that's how we got them out. Two business cards.
That's it. You need to download the video version of this show if you want to see that, because that was a perfect explanation with video. Thank you, God. Good man.
Yeah, I guess it doesn't work in audio version, but the goal is one above and one below, and then right next to the slot, give it a little squeeze pressure so that when it does try to eject, you can help it. And it works.
And if it fails, pop the thing open and take the CD out.
Well, it's a sealed unit, though, isn't it?
Well, no, you need a squidger to get into the Mac Minis, and that's a bit less fun.
Yeah. It's not for the faint of heart, but it's possible.
True. Faint of heart. I've taken a Mac Mini to pieces, and it's hard. Especially the one that fits up from the bottom with the circle on it. Jesus.
Yeah, but getting it back together is the magic, right? Taking it apart, bit of brute force, you'll get in there.
And not having a bit left over.
Yeah, iFixit.com is a godsend for these kind of things. No doubt they will have some kind of explanation for it.
Truth of the matter is, just leave it in there. What the heck you need that slot for nowadays anyway?
Exactly.
It's
good
not
point.
Hurting anything. Just
Apple says, leave it in there. I'm going to ask this question, then I'm going to have to go to the toilet because I'm going to pee my pants otherwise.
TMI.
Oh, really? Do you want to take a break?
No.
I can edit.
No. I'm just saying... There's no need to tell us why you're leaving.
Oh, okay, all right. Too much information got you. I thought so am I. Right, hi all. Love all the BTN shows. Lots of fun and useful too. I don't know what that's supposed to mean. Thanks, Eric. My internet connection is acting very weird and slowing down to almost a stop at times. I'm sure that someone is on my connection at the same time as me. I have a password. I have changed it daily for a while and use the internet at varying times of the day and night, and it still happens. Is there someone using my Mac to download things without my knowledge as well? Something's not right. How can I tell if there is something on my connection? I'm using a BT Home Hub.
I think the first thing, we've already mentioned it in the show, is Dabuki. File that up on your Mac and you'll actually see all the traffic that's currently firing about your network. And that should hopefully give you a little bit of a clue. It generally kind of goes by MAC addresses, but it also does kind of show the I don't know what the official name for it is, but it's the actual title of the device. And you should be able to kind of see, you know, because you'll see your laptop and, you know, your wife's iPhone or your kid's iPad or whatever. And then you might see one that says Dave's PC. And then that kind of will give it away a little bit. I think that's probably where I would start.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many ISPs that are so poor, I wouldn't necessarily assume if your internet connection is acting up, you're the problem. I think that's very generous to assume the problem is at your end. Yes. So like as everyone said, the router will usually list the clients, but another, if you don't trust that, or maybe your router is locked down by your ISP and you can't get at it, which, let's face it, happens. There's plenty of apps for just scanning your network. So Nmap is a free app that's been mentioned already today. And it will just look at your entire network range and see if any other IP address answers. If another IP address answers, well, then there's someone there. What shouldn't be? And if you don't want to go the Nmap route, which is a bit nerdy, there's an app in the Mac App Store called iNet, which is not free, but it is a lovely app and it's got a really nice GUI and it will scan your network and tell you what's there.
Yeah. Dabuki does a kind of similar thing as well. I think you can pay for it as well, and it does all sorts of other cool things. But this other thing, the BT Home Hub, you can actually get into, and you could even go so far as to shut and put in access control on your Wi-Fi on your BT Home Hub, which is basically just saying that only computers with these or devices with these particular MAC addresses can access the internet through this Home Hub. That's possibly a little bit long-winded because that's a pain in the arse if your friends come over with their iPhone and they want to.
It doesn't provide much protection either, because the way wireless works is that every packet, the payload of the packet is encrypted, but the packet isn't, because otherwise the Wi-Fi couldn't work, and the MAC addresses are in the packet. So if you were attacker nasty person, like the hacker apps just do this, you watch the traffic, you see a MAC address, you just take that MAC address for your own and away you go.
Yeah,
right.
The other thing, I know,
it is Dabuki, isn't it? I'm not imagining that.
No, it's Dabuki. It's Dabokee. It's named after Abe's 24 pounds, 24 pounds, 90 pence, whatever you guys call it. Don't mess me up. Yeah,
I'm going to mess you up now with euro. So the app I mentioned, iNet, is €6.99.
Oh, I'm sorry, Abe. It's 24 euro. God dang it.
I think you're right.
Currency, for Christ's sakes.
Bronwyn says she's impressed with the speed that I can pee at. I don't know what you guys said, but it obviously wasn't impressive as my peeing. And the thing is, as well, I'm going to listen back to this very carefully, because actually, where did I go to take a pee? I went behind the green screen, because actually the downstairs toilet's behind this wall. So I'm going to see if it comes out. I went behind the green screen for a pee. Okay.
Well, we couldn't hear you, if that helps.
Sarah, go ahead. You got something sensible to say.
There is one other aspect which I put in the show notes. Eric doesn't mention how old the BT Home Hub that he's using is. Now, I think probably most of them are using WPA encryption, but it's probably worth checking to make sure you're not using WEP, because it is easy to crack. And if someone is, for some reason, listening, then, and it is your Wi-Fi password you're talking about, you can crack it in a few seconds if it's WEP encryption.
I don't know if you guys have mentioned this, but I mean, Eric hasn't said what computer he's using, and there's a certain element that at times things just slow down. I mean, I've had computers that, you know, I've got two computers on the same Wi-Fi connection, and I do a speed test on both at the same time. One is like, what the hell am I paying for? And the other one's like, Jesus, wow, that's a great speed. And it for some reason, any computer just seems to slow down in all aspects, even network. And you restart again and it seems to be fine.
It doesn't say what kind of internet connection he has, I don't think.
No.
So it's possible that it's DSL or something. So if you install some sort of cloudy app that suddenly decides, do you know what, I think I'll synchronize half the planet up on this tiny little upstream bandwidth, that will completely throttle your connection. And so it could actually be an app on your Mac that's just doing something silly. Maybe your iPhones are deciding to back up to iCloud and clogging your bandwidth or something.
It could be anything, but I mean, he's on a Mac, and I'm not aware of anything, unless he's been really stupid and there's something out there that we're not aware of. I can't think he's getting anything that's really hogging data off him, or and what they're going to steal anyway. I mean,
it depends on what you have. I mean, my parents don't have great internet, and if Dropbox decides it would like to sync a file, like goodnight, good luck to everyone else on the network.
Yeah.
Do you, Bart, do you know of any, or anybody actually, know of any utility that allows you to see how much bandwidth each of your devices on your network's taken?
We see, if you want to get a really accurate answer, if the question is what is my Mac using, that's easy. You can install an app. I can dig up a link to the one I use. But it's much harder to get the answer for what's happening on the network, because really the only thing that knows that is your router. And if your router is closed, so if your router is provided by your ISP, you don't have any way to read its data off. And so that's actually a really hard question to answer. Unless you do something super nerdy, like make your own router like I did, and then I can give you graphs and everything. But that doesn't help ordinary people. It's actually a really hard question.
Right, okay.
Sorry.
That, but there's a little math you have to add to it, so it's not 100%.
Right, okay.
Okay, Sarah, you say?
No, I was just going to make the point. I think certainly, I mean, I've had BT for a long time, and I've not had any problem accessing the router. So I don't think the router's probably locked down.
But you can't put more software on it. So if one of the feature sets of the router isn't to tell you what bandwidth is going through it, then you just can't do it because you can't add functionality to the BT Home.
What I was saying was that in terms of getting access to it generally, you should be okay. Because BT normally supply the information to allow you to access the hub or the router.
I don't think it's a BT issue, I have to say.
Hey, I had a quick question. Did you guys want to see what particular app is using up all of the bandwidth, or what particular device is using up all of the bandwidth?
So my question was around device.
Yeah.
Okay, so Wireshark, man. Wireshark does that.
Or I'm just trying to find that there's a really nice Mac app that does a really, really pretty real-time graphs and stuff, breaking it down per app instead of per port. Rubbernet, that's what it's called, Rubbernet, and it's in the Mac App Store as well. And let me just get a price on that. Remember, Rubbernet is not cheap. It is €17.99.
It's not horrific.
It's not horrific, actually. No, that's true.
Stick those in the dock if you would, and we'll put.
Copying and pasting as I try to multitask, which as a male I'm terrible at.
I mean, as with all questions though, as well, Eric, send us more information and we can give you better answers. Unfortunately, if you want to send us a question, send it to bridgetechnetwork@gmail.com. We'll answer it as best we can. But the more information you give us, the more likely you are for our experts here to actually be able to solve it. If you send a photography one, I'll class myself in that group. Otherwise, I'm sorry, it's not. I'm just the bozo asking the questions.
Hey, this is cool, man. Rubbernet's on sale right now.
Oh, there we go. We like that.
Oh, so it was more expensive because I remember buying it and saying, but okay.
If you've got a question, BritishNetwork@gmail.com, we'll love it. And if you're having trouble with your BT service, especially if you're a business customer, then check out the Network Union. The Network Union is, they're a fantastic supporter of the network. They sponsor us by giving us all the pipes that come in to take all the live shows out. And they also provide us with a whole bunch of cash for the Patreon thing, because they sponsor the Patreon draw each month. Thank you very much to them. They're absolutely superb. If you've got BT... a business package, then you really, really need to talk to these guys. They will help you right size your pricing and all that kind of stuff. You're still going to keep your relationship with BT the same. You're going to get all of the support that BT has to offer, and you're still going to pay your bills to BT. But the Network Union will sit in between and provide you with an extra layer of support for everything that you do with them. They'll make sure you're getting what you pay for, but that's probably not going to be an issue. But what they really can help you with is your wide area network or your local area network, and see that that's performing the way that it should to get the maximum that you can from the BT network system that you've got plugged in. They're brilliant. You won't pay any more for their service. They are all absolutely included. So if you go to BritishTechNetwork.com/sponsors and click on the link, you can go through to the Network Union. When you go to their page, give them an address, an email address, and they'll only use that for contacting you because of the fact that you gave them the email address to contact you. They won't keep it for further marketing, and they will not sell it on to anyone else. That's a key part. So you go to the Network Union, they will talk to you. If they can't help you, they'll say, we can't help you. If they can help you, you will get the best possible support you can for your BT network. So check them out, the Network Union. They're absolutely brilliant. And the other people, of course, UK2. They're fantastic. We love them. They're absolutely brilliant. If you can, please go and buy anything that you need for the web from the network, from UK2. British Tech Network /sponsors, and you'll get through to all of the stuff that they can offer you. There's huge amounts of offer codes. You can save an absolute fortune on what you want to buy. Loads of DNSs out there now, loads of domain names out there at the moment. .London's just come out this week, I think, and .co as well, and .uk has come out too, so you can use all of those. .ninja was out the other week, and .photo, but I didn't get photography.ninja. That had already gone.
Yeah, .london is on general release from later in July, I believe. It's on you can pre-order it now.
Pre-order now, yeah, but they're good. And there's loads and loads of them coming out, so I think you'll be an indefinable list by the end of it all, so we'll see what they get. But please support UK2 because they support us. Domain names, co-location services, VPS, VPN, all that kind of stuff. Superb bunch. And good customer services as well, as Paul Wheatley will attest to.
Yes, very much so.
And if you'd like to support us, of course, then there's Patreon. We've had a great month on Patreon. Thank you very much. Over $400 donated, which is phenomenal. Thank you very much. If we provide you with entertainment each month and you want to just say thanks very much for providing us with the entertainment free of charge, then give us a donation. And tune in to the Mac Show tomorrow afternoon, Thursday, because we'll be giving away three pieces of MacPaw software free of charge to the Patreon subscribers. So if you're a Patreon subscriber, you've only got to put a dollar in or something like that, it's fine, but you will go into our free prize draw every month, and there's something fantastic every single month that you can win. Last month's was MacPaw software. We've got Clean My Mac 2 to give to you. So three people tomorrow will win Clean My Mac 2. Okay, we'll draw it at random. We've got a random name picker that we can use on the site. So Mac Show tomorrow. Then you'll find out if you've won or not. Donations, patreon.com/British Tech Network. Thank you very much. Right, it's the time for the cool tip. Mr. Wheatley, start us off. What is your cool tip?
Oh, Gaffer, I have a question, Gaffer.
Oh, go ahead.
Can I do my run out first? Because I have a TUAW show in 15 minutes.
Go for it. Sorry, thank you very much for your time. We've overrun quite badly.
I had made this sign, but I'm not going to get a chance to use it. I was going to put the Gone to Wii sign and then hashtag BTN Wii.
Good man.
Okay. Anyway, so here's a quick one. And again, for the people that are listening versus watching, it might be a little bit harder to pick out. And as a matter of fact, depending on this camera, how well it works. For instance, I'll go into face space right here. Oftentimes, Facebook does something really stupid and crash. If you happen to be running a, what do you guys call it, a beta OS like such, it crashes a lot more. So sometimes you want to get rid of just that app. And what everyone normally does is double tap the bottom.
Yep.
You get three and you kind of push them up and out of the way. But if you just want to force quit this app, just like you would do on your Mac, what you do is you hold the power key down until you get the sleep wakey slide. And instead of doing anything else, let go and hold the home button. And literally in about 6 seconds, the whole thing is going to just disappear like that. The app will go off and relaunch normally.
Oh, by itself. That's a good tip.
You've literally just killed that one app versus who said I have ginormous hands? That's not funny. You just threw me off. But you basically kill that one app. And in most cases, except for Facebook, I don't know why I picked that one, most of them will restart and they'll restart clean. But it allows you to literally guarantee flush it out. Because sometimes throwing that little thing off, even restarting the phone, the app never really went all the way off. It's sitting in that local storage memory kind of thing. I forgot what the proper iOS developer term is, but yeah. So that's how you force quit an app on an iOS device.
Right, mate. Thank you ever so much. That's a great tip, actually. I'm really chuffed with that one. Really nice. We'll leave Wheaters a bit of time to sort his video out. And in the meantime, we'll ask Sarah, what's your cool tip?
I thought I'd pick one along the lines of something we touched on earlier on. We talked about GIMP earlier on, didn't we?
Yeah.
Applications for manipulating images don't have the ability to save or create favicons. Normally you have to have specific software to do that, but GIMP actually includes that functionality, as I found out a couple of days ago, which I was delighted about. Now, for people that don't know, favicons are those little icons that you get, you know, when you open up a website and it shows you a little icon on the tab next to the name of the site. And as a web developer, it's an essential part of actually building a website to be able to do that. But they use a special kind of format called the ICO file, Microsoft format. And as I say, a lot of graphics applications won't actually allow you to say it. I'm not sure whether it's as straightforward on a Mac with graphics manipulation on a Mac, but certainly on most other things, I found it difficult to actually find something that can create .ico files, whereas GIMP does the job nicely, fantastically.
Excellent. Good one. Mr. Wheatley, what do you have for us?
So I have... and it's sort of, it's more a thing of, there we go. Can you see that there? It's basically a cable. There's not really much to see actually. what it is it's flat Cat 5, Cat 6 cable. I didn't know this existed. And I was trying to find, something that was going to allow me to put cabling into the house without having to kind of drill holes and things like that. And I didn't want to do Wi-Fi. I was kind of looking at different options and it hadn't even occurred to me to use the flat Cat 6 cable and just run it under the carpet. It's so flat. I mean, it's absolutely tiny. I would say it's probably about a millimeter thick. And you can get it in huge lengths for about the same price as regular Cat 6 cable. And you can run it under carpets. You can kind of pin it around doorways and things like that that you would never ever see it. And it's a really, really good option for putting kind of hard wiring your house for Cat 6 cable.
Now, just to qualify, pinning it doesn't mean shoving a nail through it. It means...
Indeed. Yes. Yeah. Sorry, so when I said pin it, I meant like as in kind of pinning around it. That is a good point. But I didn't know this stuff existed, and it's so flat, it's really impressive. And it's a really, really good way getting a hard wired connection to your office.
I'm totally with you, mate, but my only questions in my head were, where from and how much?
Amazon, and ridiculously cheap. I knew you were going to ask that, but I know.
Is it subscribe and save as well, by any chance?
Sorry?
Can you get it on subscribe and save by any chance, though?
No? I don't imagine you can, but I can't see a scenario where you would need it. I didn't pay too much.
Does it come terminated in particular lengths, or do you have to terminate it yourself?
Do you have to put the cable, plugs on the end?
Yeah,
the end bits on, yeah.
Yeah. No. It comes with that. So the cable that I bought was, I think it was like a 30-meter flat cable, and it was under £15 from memory.
I wish I'd known about this about 2 months ago. I ended up sawing through the little wooden bottom bits of the doors to put my Cat 6 cable around.
Right, dude, you need to post the link for that. Otherwise, I'm afraid it's not valid. We're going to go liar, pants on fire.
I discovered these flat cables a little while ago. I bought a little mini travel router. It came with one of these flat cables. I thought, oh, this is good. Like Paul, I sort of started to see all the possibilities of what you could use it for. So, they are really, really good.
I got flat USB cables, and they're absolutely brilliant for carrying around for work because you can call them up dead flat and just put a zip tie around them.
Right. I didn't know you could get. I suppose, no reason why not. I suppose.
I've got some flat 30 pins, and I've got some flat lightning cables as well. Fakes, of course, but. Yeah. Doc's got some flatties. There we go. See?
And this one is I need to charge with a buddy. So it has dock connector, Android connector, lightning connector, all flat. Super cool. But a couple quid on Amazon and you just keep it handy when you want to let someone use your charger.
Excellent, mate. Thank you very much. Superb. And Bart, what's your cool thing?
Okay. Every time someone says to me, why is a Mac cool? I always give it the same answer. It's proxy icons. And people don't seem to know about these, even though they're everywhere. So whenever you're in a document in OS X, you'll notice that the icon for the document is in the title bar of the window. And that little icon is called a proxy icon because it represents the document. And anything you can drag and drop in the Finder, you can do by dragging and dropping that proxy icon. So let's say you're working on a Word document and you want to email it to someone. Happens a lot. You could open your email, click the attach button, browse through your file system. It could be 10 folders deep, find the file, stick it in. Or you pick up the little icon from the top of your Word window. You drag it onto the mail icon in the dock and you let go. Mail will pop up a new window, the file will be attached, and away you go.
Excellent.
And this works in all sorts of places. Like if you want to drop it onto a thumb drive, drop it onto the icon for your thumb drive. Something I do a lot, if I want to get a terminal window into the same folder as a Finder window, I simply type CD space in the terminal window and then drag and drop the proxy icon from the Finder window, and it will go straight to that folder for me. It's just really handy. So whatever you can do by drag and drop with an icon in the Finder, you can do the same with the proxy icon from the title bar of the window.
That's and that just gives you discoverability, I guess. A lot more easily.
Yeah.
Yeah. Superb. £13.62 for Weta's 30 metres of cable. 8 feet of flat Cat 6 Ethernet cable. Does it come with the cable wraps as well, Paul?
So that's not the one that I actually bought. I can't see the one that I bought just now because it was kind of a white colour, because all my walls are white, so it made sense because it doesn't look. And it didn't come with the cable ties.
And it does say caution. Dispatched from Hong Kong, so you'll probably have a customs charge on top of that.
Oh yeah, okay, sorry. I'll try and find the one that I actually bought. Apologies. I didn't notice that.
Do watch out for that, because purchasing from Hong Kong, take your life in your hands there. My cool tip is not so much of a cool tip, or it is, but Bart and I were talking beforehand about going back to basics and doing stuff that I was doing 25 years ago with photography, and I was inspired by a conversation that we had on Bart's show, Let's Talk Photography, to go back to basics and just remember some of the stuff that I did when I couldn't afford to do it. And it came back from a conversation that we talked about reverse lens macro. So basically you take one lens that's on your camera and you take another lens that you've got in your pocket and you stick it on with duct tape, or you stick it on with rubber bands so that it goes the other way, and you end up being able to have a macro lens. And that's what you did when you couldn't afford to buy a proper macro lens years ago. My challenge to you is to go back and think of all the things that you could do where you don't have to spend anything. So let's say you're out in the middle of a field and you need a reflector. Instead of going and buying a reflector from B&H Video or from Wex Photography or something like that, get yourself out a padded envelope, because it crumples, it's dead easy to fold up, it'll flatten out when you open it out, and you get a fantastic white reflective surface to use when you're out in the field. Or you can take a set of tights and wrap them around your hands, and they can become your black mask for when you're doing a long exposure and then putting it back. Or you can take a set of 15 denier tights and you can make a vignette out of them on your lens, or you could make a neutral density filter out of them on your lens. There's tons of stuff that you can do. So think about what you can do that's cheap and interesting, and send us your pictures. And on the next help show, we'll show some of them. See what you can.
Can I give a quick suggestion that involves nothing more than a piece of string?
Of course you can.
So if you're outside, there's something dark, some sort of point source of light, you want to get the star effect like you see in the movies and the cool stuff. If you just take a piece of string and you put two pieces across the front of your lens in a cross shape, meeting in the middle of your lens, that will give you 4-pointed stars. If you take 3 strings, I'll give you a 6-pointed star, repeat, lather, rinse, repeat. And then you get that beautiful star effect entirely in hardware, because the string basically causes diffraction spikes, which is what you're seeing on stars and stuff, because telescopes have little struts.
Brilliant. Superb, mate. That's exactly the type of thing we want you to do. So get out there, take the pictures and send them to us and see what you can come up with. Yeah, we'll show them on next week's show. Brilliant. Where can we get a hold of you, Mr. Wheatley?
I am at Paul Wheatley on Twitter. You can find me on the Pocket Show on this network, and also on the Gamer Show alternate weeks. So the Gamer Show this week, on Monday, it'll probably be out Tuesday, we will be doing kind of covering everything that's been talked about at E3 this week.
All
the announcements from Microsoft, Nintendo, Ubisoft, and so on and so forth.
So hopefully you're going to make the expletives the lesser part of the show this week than as normal.
I think so. I think we've kind of been padding out for the last couple of weeks, because in the same way with the Mac show, you've kind of got a bit of a drought up to E3. With Gamer Show, you get a bit of a drought up to WWE. Sorry, the other way around.
Yeah, we got that. That's all right, mate.
So there was a bit of a drought on news, but the expletives will be hopefully reduced this time. We're looking at maybe get some, I'm kind of speaking to a couple of folks to get some guests on this week as well. So we get a little bit more views than just the views of myself, Chiz, and Sam.
Yes. Okay. Good one. We can get Doc Rock at Doc Rock on Twitter. And of course, you can get him on 2R at various places. So go to 2R.com and TUAW.com and link into everything that he does. He's a great help. Thank you very much for coming on, Doc. I'm sorry we've kind of run over a bit for you. Sarah, where are you, Mrs.? In the dark, by the looks.
Yes, it is slowly getting dark.
Just a little.
Because it gets darker here later than it does in the UK, I can about get away without actually using any light, because there's so much natural light. It's so much better than artificial this time of year. You can, best place to get hold of me is at Sarah Jane UK on the Twitters and Google Plus and most other places as well.
Excellent, mate. Thank you very much. And Bart, where are you, sir?
You'll find me at bartb.ie, which means you don't have to spell my surname. And from there, you'll find links to my photography on Flickr, my videos on YouTube, and my podcast at let's-talk.ie.
Excellent, mate. Thank you. My name's Ewan Rankin. You can get me at Ewan Rankin on Twitter. Help Show will be back in 2 weeks. So on a Wednesday, it's always Wednesday at 8 p.m, but every other week. Send us your questions to britishnetnetwork@gmail.com. And we'll get them answered by a fantastic bunch of people every time. Guarantee it. Thanks for listening. See you soon.